This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There is the possibility the governor and state lawmakers have blood on their hands from the state budget standoff. Take, for example, longer wait lists for treating heroin addiction because the state isn't paying.
1 week later, after the phone call was made and put on the wait list, he overdosed and died. These are the things that human service providers are now dealing with.
Here, Ann Campen of the Tazewood Center for Wellness as part of the GLT series Stretch Thinner, examining the effects of the budget standoff. Also hear about the impact of people with disabilities, plus jazz vocalist Darden Purcell. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Tazewood Center for Wellness has been offering psychiatric services to patients on its own dime since the state stopped paying for them in 2015. As part of GLT's Stretched Thinner, looking at the consequences of the budget standoff, Tazewood Chief Financial Officer Ann Campen says that can't continue forever.
Have continued to see as many as we could, but it comes at a loss of about $20,000 to $30,000 a month for us right now. We do have a very long wait list right now. The need has become greater, but we have not been able to meet the need at this time due to we just don't have the funding.
So you have spent about $500,000 then over the last year without reimbursement.
That is correct.
How long is that sustainable?
Well, it depends on what the state does this fiscal year. Right now, we're starting to have a little bit of a cash flow problem because the state is not paying on other services. So the other services that we've been able to keep going with payment from other grants and with Medicaid, those have been able to keep us going. That cash, although we've had to use up some of our reserves, when the cash quits coming due to no state budget January 1st, we will deplete even more of our reserves, and I anticipate our reserves to keep us going maybe another 4 or 5 months, and then we will have to take out a loan to continue providing mental health and addiction services.
How much worse is your financial position now than it was a year ago when we started the series Stretched Thin?
We've used up our reserves, and we are not able to make that back. We are at capacity right now. We can only meet so much of the needs of the community in mental health and psychiatry. We're finding that it's almost impossible now to even find qualified staff. People know that there's a problem in the state. They know that we rely heavily on state funding, and we can't even meet the needs anymore. We can't even get good staff in here to meet the needs in other areas where we're being paid. But right now, the cash flow problem is that, we were living on a consent decree, and that consent decree was to at least pay the Medicaid. For the Medicaid services, and some of that money came straight from the state. Some of it came through managed care. We are for the first time seeing a slowdown even in payments from managed care, the MCOs here in the area, and that is going to impact us greatly as far as our ability to even continue. But there's at this point, we can't even expand to meet the need right now.
You had said this. You had said when a person came in who had had ideations of killing a relative, mm-hmm. you had had to ask him whether he could pay for the care? And that's not a question that you would like to ask. Are you still encountering stories like that?
Absolutely. I could expand twofold, fivefold, maybe even more in that area. I don't understand what exactly is happening. The demand and the need has just expanded in the last year, and I cannot meet the needs of those people, even some who have payer sources who do have the Medicaid. But we are still asking that. We're not only asking, do they have insurance or Medicaid or anything like that, but we're to the point that a lot have gone out to the exchanges and have these incredibly large deductibles. And they've come in and maybe have a $5,000 deductible, and we need some form of payment to be able to serve them. I could go under very quickly if we don't bring in, you know, at least 50% of our cost. I'll go through my reserves much faster and close my doors much faster. But we are still asking those questions. But we're even to the point that people that do have a pay source, we're turning away because we cannot expand in that area. It's an area we're already losing thousands of dollars, and we can't lose more.
So if they feel they cannot pay all of their copay, you cannot serve them.
That is correct.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ann Campen, the Chief Financial Officer of the Tazewood Center for Wellness, for our series Stretched Thinner. It sounds like you are far closer to an existential moment than you were a year ago.
That's probably right. Yes, it is scarier times than they were a year ago, certainly. You know, we're at the point that we continue our services where we have no idea, not just in the psychiatry where we were cut. We have other areas we were not cut, but now we have no promise of providing those services and knowing whether we're going to ever get paid. We have contracts, we have grants to provide housing for those with a serious mental illness that require higher levels of care, maybe 24-hour care or 8-hour care. Typically, these are people coming out of nursing homes and out of the hospital, off the psychiatric floor. We're still seeing those people. We're still moving them into our residences without any idea whether the state will even pay us for those grants and pay for the staff time and the cost, living expenses of having those people.
In Bloomington Normal, one agency laid off 6 workers who dealt with elderly outreach services, helping them navigate the healthcare system and signing them up for the benefits for which they are eligible. And a for-profit firm took over that particular piece of the pie.
Okay.
What is happening in your area and potentially with your obligations?
We're looking for partnerships. We are looking to other ways of surviving and providing care in a different way. There's various types of partnerships you can look at. You can look at affiliating with a local doctor's office or with another provider similar to what you do, or a large healthcare system. So we've been tasked, as I'm sure most agencies in Illinois have been tasked, to figuring out how do we survive? How do we continue keeping our doors open and providing an essential service that cannot go away in our communities? So you have to look at other partners. Who can you help? Who can help you to continue providing services? So that is definitely the next year's task set for providers like us and many others, yes.
A year ago, you had talked about the problems associated with not treating people, mm-hmm. that This creates other problems in the communities and even other problems for your agency when you have to turn people away. How has that continued to transpire? What is that situation looking like?
Well, I have been hearing reports from the local hospitals, all of them, in the areas that we serve and even in counties that we may not directly serve. I'm hearing that the emergency rooms in the hospitals are just getting an influx of people, either with addictions or a mental illness of some sort. And we're hearing reports that they can't handle it. We've been asked to try to pick up that slack and help out the ERs and the hospitals. I was at a forum last week where a large healthcare provider mentioned that they have noticed a 30% increase in their ER with people who are showing symptoms of a serious mental illness. And they said in the last 18 months, and I thought to myself, well, it was about 18 months ago that mental health was cut and there was no budget, and so cash flow was depleting from the state, and I thought it has to be an outcome. We're being asked to help out, but we do not have the ability to do that. We don't have the funding, and we certainly are starting to see those cash flow issues. We can't do it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Ann Campen of the Tazewood Center for Wellness. You talked about the staff. Enlarge on that, would you? What kind of job candidates are you seeing now that you would not have looked at before but are forced to look at now?
We are seeing people that are completely unqualified. We need therapists. We need licensed therapists, people with at least a master's level in counseling or social work. And I have never seen this. I'm not aware of this agency seeing it in years. Nobody even applying for those positions. And this isn't just our agency. I'm hearing that across the state. Why would anybody with a master's level, some sort of licensure, come into a facility that is funded heavily by the state of Illinois? Why would they want to come in here? There's no job security. There's no benefits. We've all cut benefits. We haven't given raises in, for us, over 7 years. There's no pensions. What do we have to attract those people to come in here and serve the clients that need help?
That suggests you've had significant attrition.
We have.
Your caseloads have done what?
The caseloads are growing. We're spreading out our appointments less frequently with clients so we can see more clients. It impacts even just the quality of care.
Ideally, what would the rotation of appointments be and what is it now?
Well, it depends on the severity of the symptoms that the person's experiencing. Quite often, if we're serving a client that we call a linkage client coming out of a hospital, whether it be one of the state psychiatric hospitals or one of the hospitals in the state that have a psychiatric floor or a crisis floor, those types of people, when they come out, we need to see them immediately, within a week, and we need to see them frequently, at least once a week. We still have that goal of trying to get them in as quickly and see them as often as possible to make sure that they're stable, to make sure they're getting the medications that they need. But there's other clients that maybe we saw on a weekly basis that we've had to transition to every other week, or maybe every 3 weeks, or even pushing some to once a month, because we need to take the ones that are
in crisis.
Yeah, in crisis, more pronounced symptoms. So we're triaging them a little bit differently to get them through, and hopefully we make good clinical decisions that we don't allow them to go longer than they can go. You know, another agency similar to ours, they had a young man who was either heroin or opiate addicted that was ready for treatment, and he had to be put on a wait list. And 1 week later, after the phone call was made and put on the wait list, he overdosed and died. The mother called and said, remove him from the wait list. These are the stories. These are the things that human service providers are now dealing with. But, you know, when you're dealing with staff that are more limited, we don't have as many, and you have to understand, this isn't just that we've lost staff. The need for the services have increased.
How many other Peoria area providers of services like yours are no longer providing, generating that increase?
You know, I hear lots of things. I am aware of an agency actually in your neck of the woods that no longer sees the Medicaid population in psychiatry. Because Medicaid maybe pays 25, at most 30% of your cost of psychiatry. So you need other ways, grants and things like that, to supplement that so you can see them. I'm hearing doors being closed. And I we're also getting phone calls 50, 60, 90 miles away from people that need to see a psychiatrist because other agencies are either cutting back, laying off, or closing their doors completely.
Ann Campen is the Chief Financial Officer of the Tazewood Center for Wellness based in Pekin. The red ink isn't flowing quite as bad as it was a year ago at the Baby Fold in Normal, but the state budget impasse is still taking a toll on programs, services, and staffing there. As the Sound Ideas interview series Stretch Thinner continues, GLT's Willis Kern talks with Diane Schultz, president and CEO at the Child Care Center. At one point last year, the Baby Fold was running $600,000 behind in reimbursements from the state, most of that relating to an adoption preservation program. Some money became available early last year that helped mitigate the debt, but the agency used a line of credit, which Schultz says is still open.
Unfortunately, as of this date, the state of Illinois owes us about $1.2 million. Most of that is from our Department of Children and Family Services funding, and a large part of that is related to the adoption preservation home therapy program that we do in 22 counties.
The last spring, you told Charlie Schlenker that even though interest payments are included in a line of credit, it made financial sense to use the line of credit instead of tapping into some of these reserve accounts. I take it that's still the case?
Yes, that is the case. We do have a rainy day fund, like many folks do if you've managed your financial resources prudently, and those are in secure investments that we are, do better to use our line of credit, which has a lower interest rate, than to liquidate investments that have a higher rate of earnings.
How would you assess the Baby Fold's current financial situation today compared to about 1 year ago?
I think in terms of the numbers, what I said previously, the Baby Fold continues to have a very strong financial foundation for our operations because we do have a reserve investment account fund that we can utilize in addition to the line of credit. I think the thing that has made this more challenging is this ongoing increased level of uncertainty in terms of Springfield's ability to come together, create a budget, and provide some predictability for our cash flow and program operations. I don't think any of us would have believed when we chatted a while back that we would still be sitting here today without a budget in our state.
And when that chat took place about a little less than a year ago, of your overall $15 million budget, you said that you were projecting a deficit of $1.7 million. I think you said now it's $1.2 million, so it is a little bit better.
Yes, and that is because of cutbacks and things that we have tried to do to tighten our belt. We understand that everyone is doing belt tightening, whether it's business or social service or even at the state level, and we certainly are willing to continue to try to find new efficiencies in our operational costs. But it really is the unpredictability of just not really seeing any end in sight to Springfield being able to work with us as a partner and help give us some predictability for payments.
Last year, one of the consequences of being stretched thin for you was that you were forced to cut back on your residential treatment center. How are those services today?
Those services have continued. We did do that downsizing from 28 beds down to 14. And again, these are children under the age of 14 who are some impacted very significantly with mental health issues due to the trauma or abuse and neglect that they've experienced in their lives. And so we're happy that we've been able to preserve that service. We think it's very necessary in Central Illinois, and particularly for young age children that need a special level of care and treatment because of their developmental needs. But with all of our program operations, and we'll be starting to work on budgeting in April, we're going to have to continue to look at all of our program operations and make a plan for sustainability financially for those programs. And it's, again, the increasing difficulty is not knowing to what degree the state of Illinois will be able to deliver on their promise that they've given us through contractual agreements. I mean, we have signed contracts, and this is part of the issue from a business perspective that is being challenged and I think is set to be reviewed in a court case that we have signed contracts. The state has not ended that contractual agreement for these services, and they certainly are holding us accountable for providing the service. So you provide service, but you don't receive payment.
So it sounds like a lot the same as it was last year. And in the Stretch Thin series interview last year, you talked about the need to cut staff as well as services.
We are going to need to just continue to look at staffing and service provision in those programs that we're receiving direct state revenue for. And that would be within our Child Welfare Department of Children and Family Service operation.
Now, last spring, you were carefully reviewing every staffing vacancy. Is that still the case? And how would you characterize staffing related to the recent past?
That is still the case. As we experience turnover in positions, we evaluate every position to see if there is an opportunity to share tasks or distribute tasks in a certain way so that we don't have to refill those positions. And we're continuing to do that. And just to illustrate that no one's role is immune from adding extra duties, we have a planned retirement of a upper-tier administrative position at the Baby Fold. It's our Vice President of Programs and Services, and we are looking at how we can redistribute those supervisory duties across other members of our executive team, and that will be a position, an upper administrative position, that we are not going to be refilling.
Which has its plus and minuses. On the plus side, I guess, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, the more money you save, but that's a major position that you're going to have basically go unfilled.
It is a major position that really helps provide supervisory supports to our program directors that are operating our programs. And we just felt that because we're looking so critically at all of our expenses that we're not going to refill that for now. If and when we see more predictability or stability in our funding partnership with the state of Illinois, we can always reexamine filling that position. But for right now, it is viewed as not being filled indefinitely.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kernan. We're visiting with Diane Schultz, the CEO at the Baby Fold. Let's take a look at this in maybe oversimplistic terms. How has the number of kids you've been able to serve gone down in the past year?
The number of children, we have seen some changes to children being referred through our foster care programs. And I think that is really because DCFS is trying to develop other services to stabilize children in their home environments, which we philosophically agree with, and the state has been successful to some degree. We certainly have not been able to serve, even though it's 14 beds, I would say annually, that's about, 17 to 20 additional children through our residential program that are no longer being able to be served. Our school program, which is a special education school program that public schools can make referrals to for kids that have special ed needs that cannot be met in the public school. Our enrollment and our census in that program has remained steady. And we have even seen some increase in our service capacity for children with autism. So that's one program area where it's holding pretty steady.
A year ago, the budget situation had you contemplating a pivot of sorts in services based on the lagging state funds. You wondered about being able to contribute to mental health services, and this is what you told Charlie Schlenker.
We would be interested in having more discussions with other community providers that are providing services to this local population and figure out if there's a way that we could collaborate together to help move the programming for the McLean County Mental Health Initiative forward.
Has that moved forward, if at all, regarding your agency?
We have continued to be an active partner with other of our social service providers and school personnel in looking at how we can enhance mental health service delivery in our county. There have been some really strong and active work groups, including representatives from our hospitals that have been working on this. And the McLean County's board's collaborating and coordinating council for mental health is adding to that discussion. So I think that we've applied jointly for some grant funding to help support mental health services in our county. There have been some grants, I believe, that have been awarded related to some juvenile justice programming, but not so much on the broader mental health array of services. But this is an important example to provide. It is part of the charitable mission of the Baby Fold to use our donor dollars to contribute serving unmet needs in our community. Just think what the Baby Fold might be able to contribute to local needs, such as our county mental health initiative, if we weren't spending approximately $1.2 million a year to make up for the shortfall in what the state revenue is not paying or providing. So it really has a ripple effect, not only in terms of services that are being provided through contracts with the state, but it has a ripple effect all the way down to local communities and the needs of the local citizens as well.
You bemoan the fact that as of last spring, you had gone about a decade without any rate increases in state funding. Has it really gotten to the point where that's really just pie in the sky wishful thinking?
Well, I think it has reached a level of critical need now that even our statewide association that represents child welfare and residential programs, it's called the Child Care Association, has made it a formal part of their legislative platform to discuss in earnest the fact that providers need some level of rate relief. It is just unconscionable when we are providing the care and mental health treatment for these children who are in the custody and guardianship of the state of Illinois to have received no increase for 10 years in providing those critical mental health services. So it is going to be actively talked about how far that will progress. Time will tell, but there are programs around our state that are continuing to downsize or close their doors, and then the mental health services for these children are going unmet.
The common argument given by social service agencies for being funded is that it's cheaper to treat problems on the front end than to treat them on the back end. Now, the problem with this is that at least for a while, there's going to be a need for spending on both ends. And you're told there's no money for that. So you multiply this not only by social service agencies, but higher education, K through 12, all the other things the state spends money on. How does the state get past this cycle?
Well, I think that, you know, the individual decisions that agencies, whether it be social service, higher ed, school districts, that all of our decisions can help play a part in resolving those competing priorities. As I mentioned last time I was here, the Baby Fold has made a conscious commitment that we are going to continue to invest in prevention work to prevent trauma, to prevent adverse experiences happening to children, and that's our Healthy Start program. We have that program. It is a research-tested and proven model with exceptional outcomes for taking some really high-risk young mothers, intervening prenatally, providing supports on up through age 5 if necessary. And we know that we are about 97 to 98% successful with not having cases of abuse and neglect in those homes. And we are just standing by that program. So as we continue to look at the other deficits for foster care or residential that we need to try to cover, we believe that we have a moral obligation as part of our agency mission to prevent harm and trauma to kids, and we are going to make those investments that we need to support those types of programs.
That's Diane Schultz, CEO of the Baby Fold in Normal, speaking with GLT's Willis Kern. Schultz says the state has hit a crisis point in social service funding. She encourages every citizen to make their voice heard. She says Illinois now has $11 billion in unpaid bills, up from $6 billion just 2 years ago. Schultz says interest is mounting on that debt, and Illinois' status continues in free fall with bond rating agencies.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Taking a big empty space and then filling it with original art might be intimidating to some, but it invigorated one Illinois State University student and challenged her to bring even more of herself to her creations. Laura Kennedy talks with the artist who has her work on display at the 2017 MFA Biennial at the University Galleries in Normal.
Emily Lehman is a first-year MFA student in the Illinois State University College of Fine Art and is one of 17 student artists whose work is currently on display in the MFA Biennial. Her work, Cheek to Cheek, is a huge collage creation that takes up an entire corner of the university galleries. Kendra Pates is the gallery's head curator. She says the MFA show highlights the various points in the artist's growth during the program. Gallery director Barry Blinderman says, for the public, the MFA exhibition really shows off the collective talents of the graduate students like Emily Lehman.
The range of both materials and conceptual problems that they're dealing with is really incredible.
It also gives the students an opportunity to see their work outside of the studio and outside of the classroom and to see it within the context of what their peers are making. So these relationships start to emerge that maybe aren't so evident when these works are in separate studios, surrounded by just that artist's work and their materials.
Could this be the first time a student would actually have their work on display in a big show?
It might be for some.
For some, yes.
And then they get this chance to see their work with good lighting, a really clean space. In addition to showing off their work and showing it off to the public, you know, we're always thinking about how do these opportunities serve students? And something like getting great installation shots for their website that shows what their work looks like on display is actually an important kind of secondary function.
We consider this an evolving process, too. Before the show, long before the show, we had a meeting, and several of the grad students came, and we just said, look, you got 16.5-foot ceilings here. What are you going to do to take advantage of this extraordinary space? And we encouraged people to just go beyond. For example, in the case of Emily, she was thinking, yeah, I'll just put a couple paintings in. And I said, well, wait a minute, I've been to your studio, and you have all of these beautiful collaged elements. You know, your whole life is in there. Why not bring your studio out into the gallery?
Emily, let's talk about your work. Your installation's right around the corner.
Yes.
So let's just walk around the corner here.
Okay.
We have an installation with bits and bobs and scraps all along the wall and tied up to the ceiling and strings coming down. Tell me about the installation.
Sure. It's called Cheek to Cheek. So this installation in some ways was about me unpacking my studio, that it's sort of become an installation space in and of itself. And I spoke with Bear and he's like, you should just bring this into a larger space, use the gallery.
What did you think about that?
Well, I thought it was a great idea, but I also didn't know because everything had existed in one space before then. And so this has been a great opportunity to sort of reorganize the pieces that I've been assembling for a while now. There is no plan until I arrive at the site, and so it's sort of the no plan, plan mantra there. But I'm interested in responding to a space and responding to what I'm subconsciously thinking in the moment and the materials I have at hand. So
let's talk about how you did respond to this space. So we have walls going up 16 and a half feet. Was that at all intimidating with, hey, what am I going to do with this? Or did you just pounce on it like a lion?
I pounced like a lion. For some reason, it wasn't intimidating. I think maybe because I had no specific plan, it was exciting to me. And so this fort-like structure came out of it. I think the height is essential in the piece for that reason. Sort of this ambiguous entering but closed off space happens, I think.
Is that a figure that I see in there as well? You're calling this cheek to cheek. Is there a figure behind all that string there against the wall? Are you hoping that when viewers come here that they're going to project and see what they want to see in here?
Yes, I'm hoping for that. I'm hoping, I think something about the piece resonates that the artist or a person was present within it. And so I'm interested in this suggestion of a figure or a person. I like that it's open and you can question it. And I start to see more figures within the piece the more I start to look for them, which is interesting too.
Tell me about the choices you made with regards to the materials, because we have a wide variety of material here, from bricks, we have string, we have fabric. It just seems like you had a joyous time putting all this together.
I did. Part of my fascination in my practice is just this collection and sourcing of materials, but also this altering of materials and my own interactions with the history and what's touched it before me and then how I touch it and then how it's presented to an audience. So it's hard to say exactly why I collect the materials that I do, but they all enter my studio and then sort of to get shuffled around and played with a ton.
I like the fact that you use the phrase played with. Mm-hmm. You have a playful approach to art then.
I do. For me, I don't think it should be taken too seriously. I think it should be open and fun. I think there's more to it than that as well, but I think that's essential for me in making.
Kendra, tell me what you think of Emily's work.
Well, I think it's really exciting. I mean, we've loved having her here with us. So many of the students have been in here installing their work over the course of the week, so it's been really vibrant and exciting to have everybody coming in and out. But especially seeing a first-year student who's just completed her first semester kind of dive in and be ambitious and experiment and just kind of respond to the space and go for it was really exciting. I mean, we really try to encourage that both for the students we're working with and the artists who are already out in the world. You know, we throw around this phrase a lot, laboratory of expression, being in a university environment. And we really pride ourselves on trying to give those opportunities to artists. And, you know, I think we've all had really fulfilling conversations with Emily over the course of the week, too, talking about her approach, talking about the materials she's using, the histories of those materials. For me, it's exciting to see how evident her hand is in it, that she's not just bringing these existing materials into a space, but she's really manipulating them. If she's putting tape on the wall, she's making a pattern with the tape, then she's drawing in between it. She's drawing on the wall, painting over materials, adding layers upon layers of information. These legs you talked about, these boards that are kind of going up the wall, have these kind of cascading pieces of fabric that are cut out around these pink circles, these pink dots coming down. And we were talking about how different an experience would be of seeing those dots painted in flat paint on a flat surface versus being cut out of fabric and kind of dripping and draping and twisting down the wall.
It's this piece is a verb. It's a verb. It's not really a subject. It's a piece that was becoming and is becoming as you discover various things in it that you didn't see before. And I think what Emily's done is brought pieces of her life into another space. She probably had a general idea or a concept of what she was doing, but I don't know whether she was definitely thinking from the start of incorporating those rays of string to bring it out into the space, which makes it look like a domicile. It almost encourages people, I don't think they're going to do it, to just walk in. But, you know, the tent-like structure there just seems like it's an oasis for an artist to discover herself.
That's Barry Blinderman and Kendra Pates from the University Galleries, along with artist Emily Lehman. The MFA Biennial is currently up and continues through February 12th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can find a gallery of photos of Cheek to Cheek at our website, wglt.org.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God.
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing. It looks empty.
No, there's someone living back there.
Is a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil?
This American Life. Saturday at noon on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Marianne Webb and Don Carlson of Sulaski & Webb CPAs, providing audit and accounting, tax and management advisory assistance with special emphasis on personal service and quality. More information at SulaskiWebbCPA.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Vocalist Darden Purcell returns to Central Illinois this weekend when she and her husband, guitarist Sean Purcell, guest at the Illinois Wesleyan University Jazz Festival. In this encore edition of GLT Jazz Next, John Norton talks with Purcell via Skype from her home in the Washington, D.C. area.
You'll get bold. You can't resist him, and all you'll say when you have kissed him is, ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
The vocalist is Darden Purcell. It's her take on What a Little Moonlight Can Do. It's from her 2009 album, Easy Living. It's an album she recorded while pursuing her master's and DMA in jazz studies at the University of Illinois. Also during that time, Purcell and her husband, guitarist Sean Purcell, were regular performers around Central Illinois. Darden Purcell is now director of jazz studies at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. She says, as a vocalist, she brings a perspective that's a bit different than an instrumentalist would bring to a university jazz program.
I'm in a little bit of an interesting position as a vocalist. There are not many of us in the nation. I would say there's probably about 5, perhaps maybe 10 vocalists that are actually running programs at major universities. And so I do feel like I bring a different perspective to it. I think at times it can be challenging, but you know, vocalists are a very, very large part of the jazz world, whether people kind of want them to be or not. And I think a lot of players, as they get older too, they start kind of realizing and the importance that vocalists can play in the programs and the different perspective that we bring to the genre, especially when you're talking about lyrics and melodies and how all of that can kind of influence. And we're certainly obviously influenced by instrumentalists our whole life. So it's kind of nice to have the vocal perspective be a part of the program as well.
You're returning to Central Illinois for a performance at the Iron Post, and one of the people you're playing with is your former professor, Chip McNeil, who's the head of the jazz program at the University of Illinois. How did Chip help you kind of get to where you are right now?
Oh, Chip and I go back way far. He's known me since I was 19 years old. He was actually the head of the jazz studies program at Virginia Tech, where I received my undergraduate degree. So I knew Chip when I was really young. Chip and his wife, Lisa Ann Lyons, were running that program. And then once I graduated, I joined the Air Force and kind of moved around. And then when Sean and I decided to go back to grad school, we were able to hook back up with Chip.
And now at George Mason, you're doing the same job that he is doing at the University of Illinois. What was it maybe that he, as the head of the jazz program, that you picked up from him that you can apply to what you're doing right now?
Pretty much everything. You know, Chip does everything at the Illinois. He, you know, not only teaches all the classes, but does all of the administrative work. And I think the one thing that I've really learned from Chip is not only his great musicality and his passion for the music, but also there was never a time that I emailed Chip that he did not get back to me within the hour. I can't think of one time. He was unbelievable at getting back to people so quickly and just taking care of students and getting people what they needed. And I really try to emulate that in my job right now of just, you know, you've got to get back to people right away because everything is happening in real time and moving very quickly. And he's really great at that.
Well, Glenn Wilson, another guy you know, when he moved from New York City to Virginia, he told me he was amazed and quite happy to find that the jazz talent level in Virginia was extremely high. And coming from New York City, he thought, oh boy, I'm going to go quite a bit down in talent level, but that really wasn't the case. Glenn now lives here in central Illinois, and again, for a relatively small rural area, this area has quite a bit of talent, starting with Chip McNeil.
Right. It was amazing. Sean and I moved from Nashville, Tennessee in 2007 to start our graduate studies there. And, you know, we were a little bit apprehensive because both of us had never lived in a smaller city. Sean's from Pittsburgh and I'm sort of from the Washington, D.C. area. So we were a little bit nervous thinking, oh, I hope that there's going to be places to play and great musicians. And we were extremely pleasantly surprised at not only the level of musicians, there are some of the most outstanding players are in central Illinois. Also, just the camaraderie of all the musicians. Everyone gets along, everyone knows each other, everyone performs with each other. It was really amazing. And we just really felt like we were at home. As soon as we walked in to see you, we just thought, okay, this is going to be a great 4 years.
Last year, I got to talk to a couple of kids from around here. I call them kids, Adam Larson and Ryan Weisside. They're both from Bloomington Normal. They're saxophonists trying to make a go of it in New York City. You know, they're doing two different things, both musically and business-wise. But when I was talking to them last year, both of them said, you know, we went to some really cool jazz schools and some amazing professors and things like that. But he said one thing they both could have got a little bit better was more of the business side of music, more of the business side of jazz. As an educator and ahead of a jazz program, what do you do or what do you think needs to be done to place a little more emphasis on the business side of jazz?
Right, that's a great question. I feel the more professional level experiences that students get, the more that helps them to kind of navigate that world as soon as you graduate. Because, you know, college can be a little bit of a bubble where you're sort of playing at being an adult and being out there, but you're not quite there because you still have the support of the university or your parents. And so I feel it's really important that the more kind of outside gigs that students can be doing while they're in school as well too, teaches them about how to act, what's appropriate etiquette on a gig. Also, just what I was talking about before, getting back to people right away. If you do not get back to people, you'll lose opportunities. You know, making sure that you're also getting together the business side of it, resumes, photos, all the online technology you can do now with websites. There's so much that can be done and really should be done. That way, as soon as you graduate, you have kind of a whole package together so you can go out there and start working. You're not going to get everything from that because so much of life experience is just happens on the gig, you know, and some of the things that happen that you thought, well, I never thought of that before, but now I know what to do in that situation. But, you know, just trying to get together as much as you possibly can, not only musically, but yeah, the business side of it is very, very important. There are some incredible players out there who don't have the business side together and they don't work as much. So that is really important.
Do you feel that's a responsibility of the jazz program itself?
I don't feel like it's our entire responsibility. I feel like it's part of it, you know? I definitely feel like it's part of it. And especially for the programs where the professors are still out there playing and working a lot, I think the students are going to naturally see what their professors are doing and try to kind of emulate that as well, too.
Well, one more question about your recordings. You put one out roughly a little over 5 years ago. Another recording on your agenda anytime soon?
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely time. I've been thinking over it the past year. I can't believe it's already been 5 years since my recording. My hope is to try to record something this summer. If not this summer, then the next summer. I'm just kind of right now in the creative process of trying to figure out which direction I want to go. And quite frankly, I was so happy with my first recording. I'm a little bit nervous about that second one to think, am I going to be as happy with it? I'm sure that I will be, but I was just so pleased with the whole first experience. I want to make sure that I do justice to the second one.
Darden Purcell, nice to catch up with you a little bit, and good luck on your return to Champaign-Urbana here this week.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for the time. I appreciate it.
Living for you is easy living. It's easy to live And I'm so in love. There's nothing in life but you. I'll never regret the years I'm giving. They're easy to give. I'm happy to do whatever I do is for you.
That's jazz vocalist Darden Purcell talking with GLT's John Norton. The song is the title track to Darden Purcell's 2009 release, Easy Living. Purcell and her guitarist husband, Sean Purcell, are guest artists this weekend at the Illinois Wesleyan University Jazz Festival. The concert is tomorrow at 12:45 in Westbrook Auditorium at IWU. In addition, jazz director Glenn Wilson is having IWU Jazz Fest at Jazz Up Front tonight from 8 to 11 and doing a concert at the Western Avenue Community Center. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. Find Stretched Thin and this year's Stretched Thinner at our website, WGLT.org, which is where you can find archived episodes of Sound Ideas, along with individual interviews today from Willis Kern, Mike McCurdy, and John Norton. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas and the interviews you hear. Share your thoughts after the show at WGLT.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.